Today's program is brought to you by Modernist Pantry, providing magical ingredients for the modern cook. For free videos, recipes, tips, and tricks, visit blog.modernistpantry.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you pre-recorded from the Ace Hotel in Pittsburgh, PA. Joined, not as usual, with Nastassia the Hammer Lopez. She is not here. She is in New York City. And Dave is also not in the booth because we are pre-recorded from the Ace Hotel in Pittsburgh. But we do have, just like last week, the evil cocktail overlord of the universe, Don Lee.
Benevolent.
Now that he's my new business partner, I guess he's supposed to be benevolent. But I thought you liked being the secret evil.
The secret evil, the operative word is secret.
So we've gone through this before. So, wait, you have to refresh me because it's a little late in the evening. I know you're much more into this kind of Star Wars universe timeline. Which, like, when is he good? Is he good when he's Senator Palpatine? No.
Always bad.
Well, when is he theoretically good? When does Amidala still listen to him? When his name is what?
That's why he's a secret overlord in the beginning. He's Kevin, secret bad.
Kevin, you haven't been introduced yet. Also joined again with Kevin Denton, who is the I swear to God, folks, his title is international mixologist for Pernod Ricard. Is that a true story, Kevin?
It's just national, David.
Oh well, what about Canada? What about Canada?
I think we have something grandfathered in that I take Canada too.
That's two countries
on request.
That's two countries.
Yeah.
You've been to Mexico. What about Mexico?
It's the best place on earth.
Do they have their own Kevin Denton, or are you the Kevin Denton of Mexico as well?
I would imagine they have someone better.
Oh, well, Kevin Denton, for those of you that don't know, and you can't call in your questions because this is pre-recorded, but if you could have called in about the bar program at WD50 or at Alder, about what he's doing at Pernod Ricard now. But you know what? Something we didn't discuss last week, because you... By the way, the reason we're doing these pre-recorded is... we've all been fortunate enough for the past week and a half to be doing a multi-city tour discussing new and interesting bar techniques, where Don and I have been doing demonstrations to bartenders in Pittsburgh, Denver, and San Diego about kind of new techniques in the bar industry. But also, we've been doing presentations. Good folks from Death & Company and whatnot have been doing presentations on... What was their presentation on, Kevin, technically?
The art of training.
Right, which is actually important. I think people
riveting.
Don't... People, it was actually a really good talk. People don't take training. It's not they don't take it seriously. They don't think far enough in advance about how important training is, both in a culinary standpoint. And I guess they do. You know, I would think people take training more seriously in a culinary standpoint, not in front of house, but in back of house. But bar training, I think, is an important thing. And it's taken seriously by people who are working as consultants doing they're doing multiple bars. They have to roll out their training because they can't always be there, right?
Well, I think you made a good point earlier that, like, if you really want to know something, you should have to teach someone how to do it, right? If you train someone, then you really have to know what you're doing in the first place. And I feel like those guys really know what they're doing and therefore are really able to articulate good training.
Right. You know what's the dumbest saying in the world? Those who can't do, teach. That's the dumbest damn saying in the whole freaking world. Like, if you can't, in the culinary world, and in many other worlds, I assume as well, if you can't teach, it means you don't have any idea what the hell you're talking about. You know what I mean? It's, I guess there are people who are just non-communicative kind of savants who are really good practitioners, but... You know, the inability to be able to articulate what you're doing and teach the next, like, group of people how to do it just means that you're, you know, maybe useful for your customers, but you're not useful to the future of the profession. So, anyway, I think that's a crappy saying. And we have new guest today, Brian Bartels. So Brian wrote a book that just came out this year called The Bloody Mary. Now, it's the lore. Give me the full
lore and legend of the classic cocktail of brunch and beyond for every little school kid who's ever wanted to aspire to make a Bloody Mary.
Wait, that's the longest title in all time.
Yeah, yeah,
true enough. That's true.
So give me some lore and legend.
Lore and legend. The book itself, the Bloody Mary book, published by Ten Speed in March of 2017, basically establishes the background history of the Bloody Mary, how it came to be named the Bloody Mary, and also 50 recipes, three different categories encapsulating classic recipes, modern recipes, and then hosting party large format recipes.
Okay, so give me some quick history. So Bloody Mary, is it some sort of Mary Queen of Scots thing or what?
It's not.
She didn't drink a lot of tomato juice.
One of the four legends is Mary Queen of Scots, which is great, but at the same time, not the validity of what we have come to know today as our favorable first cocktail of the day.
So what's the current accepted history of the Bloody Mary cocktail?
It's established in corresponding with Mary Warburton, who is a socialite, a Philadelphia socialite, if there ever was one.
Amazing name, Warburton. Warburton.
A very it famous family from Philadelphia. Definitely rich.
I mean, if I had...
It's a Dexter, up. Dexter C.K. Haven, Dexter.
If I had the $50 to go down to City Hall, I would change my name to Warburton.
All would. If the four of us could be the four mighty Warburtons.
That'd be amazing. Okay, so...
It's a Wes Anderson film, isn't
it?
It
could be, actually, the next Anderson
film. So why would they name it after her first name, which is, you know, nice but unremarkable, when it could have been called the Bloody Warburton?
That is a much more badass name.
Yeah.
That sounds like a Scotch drink.
Yeah.
So, talk.
In Prohibition, 1927, in Florida, there was a...
yes, indeed. That's not where I wanted to be.
The Golden Age.
George Jessel was a vaudevillian entertainer, comedian, actor, what have you.
Was he any good? Have you seen any of his work?
Never seen a single thing that he's done other than his Smirnoff ads. He was a Smirnoff campaign ambassador in the 50s.
Really?
Yeah.
How were his ads?
His ads were... he had a little bit of a... barrel-chested,
six-pack ads.
Boastful, yeah. Like, he looked like a beefier Bob Hope. Before Bob Hope was, I guess when Bob Hope was skinny at the time, because he was probably alive in 1950.
He was alive up until, yeah. Come on, man. How old are you? Bob Hope was alive until, like, in my life recently. I mean, Bob Hope lived to be a billion.
Yeah. Listen, Mary Warburton clearly caused a lot of trouble.
Okay, Mary Warburton, Florida, some vaudevillian dude, 20s.
1927, okay. When vodka was not even available, George Jessel claims that he was looking behind the bar after an all-night drinking outfit with all of his friends, and they were trying to stay up. It was 8 a.m., and he grabbed bottles behind the bar to make a concoction.
I don't believe that this is not a story I believe.
It's not a story I wholeheartedly believe either, but... it gets associated with every Bloody Mary story that's ever been, like...
This sounds like a lie. Don, what do you think? Is this a lie?
I don't know. I'm just shocked by the Wikipedia fact that Kevin Denton showed me, that Bob Hope was born in 1903.
Yeah,
Bob Hope. So in the 1950s, Bob Hope was 50 years old.
He was my age. Not even. Like, before 1950.
This man lived to be 100. He died in 2003.
Yeah. Yeah, which to me is yesterday. 2003 for 2003. Me is yesterday.
I would rather Bob Hope created the Bloody Mary. To be
all right,
honest.
All right. So this vaudevillian Smirnoff peddler and Mary Warburton are hanging out, sweating their tookuses off in 1927 Florida, and the guy happens to find a buttload of tomato juice behind the bar. Why you would have tomato juice in 1927 in Florida, only God knows.
Impossible.
Right, okay, so let's carry this improbable story to its conclusion. What happens?
He makes all of these, he basically assembles Worcestershire, lemon juice, vodka, which he calls vodka, because it was a potato, a rancid smelling spirit.
This is a horror show. Okay, go ahead.
Exactly. he brings all of these items together, along with the tomato juice, which had just only recently been canned.
By the Sacramento Corporation?
By Cottage Inn.
Cottage Inn.
Michigan. And once he puts, what were you about to say? Once he puts everything together for Mary Warburton and all of his other friends, everyone deems it an actual acceptable savory drink. They're all talking, drinking, having fun, still up all night, and the drink gets spilled on Mary Warburton's white dress. And she jokingly says, "George, now you can call me a Bloody Mary."
Wait, so is this a so weird, loose. Is this a weird, like...
I agree.
Is this a weird, like, is it just a blood reference? Is it a sexual reference? Is it, like, is it some sort of, like...
Dave, family show.
Well, I'm just curious, like, no, this is history. So this is history.
We're talking about, I mean, Duran Duran wasn't a band yet, but, like, at the same time...
Very much not so. Like, you know...
It could have been... Mary Warburton could have been Rio, and she could have been dancing on the sand, but at the same all right, time,
well, I see where you're trying to go with this, but this is one of those stories that to me sounds like...
far-fetched.
Well, horse hockey, you know what I mean? And so, like, also, like, I don't know whether you've ever had a drink mixed by a vaudevillian in the morning when they're hungover in the piss-hot heat.
Doesn't seem feasible.
No, I mean, like, I'm like...
They're the only people that would come up with the combination of tomato and Worcestershire, you know, at that time of day. That sounds like crazy talk to
and
me.
And a very kind of, like, not vodka town. Like, no one in Florida then was drinking vodka.
No.
Like, you know, Martha Stewart wasn't even, like, alive then, much less drinking. So no one was drinking, like vodka in Florida at that point. And, you know... It just seems very not sort of feasible.
No, but the way that the Bloody Mary actually developed and was eventually, I think, established was because of Fernand Petit, Pete Petit, as his nickname was.
Petit,
bartender at the St. Regis.
Petit Pablo's, like...
The King Cole Bar.
What?
The King Cole Bar at St. Regis in New York. He
just off of Central Park.
But that's not extant.
It's still there, yeah.
Really?
Great martinis. It's like going to be like a 10-ounce martini, but...
Why would I want a 10-ounce martini? That's a nightmare. Give me two 5-ounce martinis. That's a freaking nightmare. People, the end of the world has happened. Two 5-ounce martinis is what you want.
But also, go for the mural, Humpty Dumpty. Beautiful mural.
It's one of the sexiest rooms in New York City.
Yeah, it's a great room.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they recently did a anniversary Bloody Mary party a couple of years ago.
Ostensibly the birthplace of the Bloody Mary.
Oh, I thought you just said your boy...
Two rabbit holes here. That's the name of the Bloody Mary.
And when in doubt, blame it on Hemingway.
Was ostensibly created by George Jessel.
Okay, listen.
Pete Petit... Was the bartender who brought basically what I liken to say is if Jessel owned the Cadillac, Pete Petit took it out onto the highway and developed it. So there's been a hard enough time locating the identity of who created the Bloody Mary.
When did this guy die? When did Petit die?
Late 60s, early 70s. So and he claims in 1964 in a New Yorker article that George Jessel created it. But then I developed it. So Petit put in...
He cayenne. Name calls this Jessel dude.
Yeah. So it's Jessel's.
No, it's not. Hey, wait, you're telling me that Jessel didn't even have, like, any sort of spice in it? Then it's not a freaking Bloody Mary.
Exactly, which is why I think Petit bloody is garbage. The one who develops... Exactly. Our modern-day version of the Bloody Mary is Petit's. It's Petit. So I give Petit the credit for establishing the Bloody Mary.
I don't know if you know this, but... I like listening to David Wondrich, who, for those of you who aren't in the cocktail world, is like the cocktail writer about history par excellence. But I enjoy the histories of the cocktails, but I find them almost always to be garbage and unsatisfying. In fact, most histories and most etymologies I find, unless they are, they just don't have kind of meaning to me. You have to do it. You have to talk about it. People ask you for it, but it doesn't really talk about why you think X, Y, or Z thing is important. Right, so let's get to the more important meat rather than trying to think of like these knucklehead hungover fools in the 20s in Florida. Which why would you live in Florida before air conditioning? Like why would you live in that? There's no DEET, right? You had no DEET.
No DEET.
You had no air conditioning.
You could have had DDT.
I don't know. Did they in the 20s?
It's like a 70s, you know.
70s, that's 50 years. You're living in a place without bug spray and without air conditioning. It's just skaters and gators all freaking day. Palmetto, palmetto bugs, sulfurous groundwater. Like, Florida is fine now because we have civilization to override the inherent nightmare that is the flat, sandy bar that is that state of Florida, which, fine place, but not in the freaking 20s, right?
Is that before or after Jerry Seinfeld's parents moved there?
I assume before. And, you know they have a whole breed of cattle in Florida, the cracker cows, that are, in fact, like these cows that are bred. They're these skinny, scrawny, weirdo cows that can stand hanging out in the humid heat, poor soil, palmetto-eating, like, bug nastiness that is Florida prior to modern technology. Wait,
can they handle brackish water? Are they like the Ossabaw pig? Because that sounds delicious.
Or like the San Michele sheep of the Florida. Maybe. I've never had a Florida cracker cow. Someone out there.
So why are you railing on cracker cows if you've never had one?
I'm not. I think they're awesome. In theory, I've never eaten one.
Well, that was a flip-flop, right?
Like. No. I never say anything bad about the cow. The cow's a tough son of a cow. It's a cow. It's like tough. In fact, there's a whole sub. There's a guy named Rhett. What's his last name? I forget. He's a pastor and a cow whip maker.
And he was vaudevillian.
He's alive today. Don't make fun of this man. He's a real life human being with children, and he makes cow whips out of nylon because in Florida it's so humid that if you make a leather whip, it will rot into nothingness in like 2 seconds flat.
I've been told that kangaroo leather is the best leather for making whips.
Yes, but they don't have kangaroos in
Florida. Everybody knows that.
Everybody knows that kangaroo leather is the finest whip making leather in the world. This is like, if you don't know that, why am I even talking to you? Like, if this is not just a freaking given that kangaroo leather is the toughest, supplest, best cracking whip leather that God has ever created, then there is no further discussion for us to have about any subject.
That's our sponsor this week, right?
Yeah, kangarooleather.com. You know, the guy, David Morgan, who made the whips for the Indiana Jones movie, he obviously uses Australian kangaroo hide for his better whips, sometimes with some kind of BS regular, like, cow belly on the inside. And just kangaroo on the outside for his lesser whips. But Australia is the best whip-producing country in the world by far, and it's because they have the best raw materials. They are the DRC, if you will, of whip-making. And it's just a known fact. And what's strange is that all of us as Americans are completely obsessed with the bullwhip because we grew up with Indiana Jones and his crappy fedora, which is, by the way, wore a crappy fedora. Like, I'm just going to go ahead and say that. I love myself some Harrison Ford. He once pushed me aside at an art event years ago, and I was like, ooh, I was shoved aside like a piece of garbage by Harrison Ford. I finally made it in the art world in New York. And, I love Harrison Ford, but that is not what the traditional Australian whip is like. They use a different style of whip in Australia, and I think since they have the kangaroos, we should probably look at their style of whip because they probably have something to tell us. Just saying. I don't know how we got on that subject. We were talking about Bloody Marys.
Yeah.
So my question is, Brian.
Yeah.
Why did you get interested in the book? Do you like Bloody Marys? In other words, here's my question. So, like, I do a lot of work with cocktails. Sometimes, like, I do a lot of work, but someone's like, would you order that? I'm like, no. I would not order that. I would have a glass of rosé instead. So, do you actually order the Bloody Marys, and why is it only a breakfast drink? Is it because it's gloppy and no one wants to drink gloppy stuff at night? Or what?
Well, it was the first cocktail I ever learned to make. I had to learn to make it in order to be a bartender. So that was part of my introduction and a huge part of it. If I wanted to be a PM bartender, if I wanted to learn how to make cocktails, I had to make a Bloody Mary at brunch. That's part one. Part two was...
So what's the brunch customer like?
Well, in Wisconsin...
From your side, from the bartender's side, what's a brunch customer like?
When I was learning to make the Bloody Mary, or what the modern day version of a brunch customer is like?
Your choice. Like, what are your feeling about brunch customers?
people are very thirsty, and the lack of correspondence or communication is sometimes a little gray with people. I understand that. You're still trying to wake up. You're trying
Shouldn't
to
you
like,
know what they want?
You should kind
they
of.
They either want a mimosa or a Bloody Mary, Brian. Like, there's two things they want.
Coffee and a big
water. But they
want
a coffee. They want a coffee. They want a water. They want, like...
Big water.
There's
big
abstract,
water.
There's abstractions
just
to, like,
one,
what the request
one sip,
of a brunch
water.
Of a brunch drinker really wants. It's kind of confusing, but at the same time, you're there to, like, facilitate any request.
So, wait, I'm assuming you also had to make mimosas. Why didn't you write the mimosa book?
I didn't have to make a lot of mimosas. In my 20-year career as a bartender, I actually didn't have to make a lot of mimosas.
What?
I kind of feel blessed.
What are your thoughts on the Bellini?
I didn't have to make a lot of Bellinis.
No. Don didn't ask you whether you had to make them. Don said, what are your thoughts on the Bellini?
I don't think much about the Bellini.
Oh.
Good answer.
When you don't think about it, or you think it's a garbage drink?
I don't think much about it.
Here's my point. I think a Bellini can be delicious, often is not. I have the same feeling about Bloody Marys, frankly. So why don't you tell me why so many Bloody Marys are garbage and how you make one that's not garbage?
Good question. Well, to follow up on your previous question, I actually, my palate had to evolve. That's how I got to like Bloody Marys and started to engage them a little bit more.
Called your palate not evolved.
My palate is somewhat, it's constantly being checked, which is important. But at the same time, what was your question again?
First, well, why did you choose to write a book on Bloody Marys? And you say it's the first drink you had to perfect. Second, like, why, like, what makes a Bloody Mary good and so many are garbage and why are so many garbage? And third, I'll tack on to this, why is it only a breakfast drink? Is it because nobody wants to drink gloppy drinks at dinner?
You need him to chime in, Dave has plenty of opinions.
By the way, I don't mean gloppy in a pejorative way.
No, that's okay. I actually feel like the reason I got so involved in it, and the more I started writing about it and researching and developing the Bloody Marys, was I actually don't like the viscous, soupy, thicker versions of Bloody Marys. I think the bad Bloody Marys are the prepackaged Bloody Marys. If they're house-made, I'm a little bit more inclined to try them. And actually, in the book tour that I've been doing, everybody's been telling me that their response to Bloody Marys and how they've enjoyed them that much more in the last 5-10 years has been directly related to people who are creating them from, like, the ground up. And I think that's important, actually, because you're channeling a certain kind of texture and dimension with however you're making your Bloody Mary. If you're using prepackaged Bloody Marys,
come on, please. I mean, please. You know, please. If you're going to have a cheese plate, you don't pull out the Kraft Singles.
No.
Kraft Singles are great on certain things, Kevin. Kevin Dent is giving me the stink eye.
I'm just saying.
It's not a cheese plate.
If you're going to make an analogy like that, say something bad at the end. If it's going to be X, don't be Y. If Y is superior, like, singles are better than most Bloody Mary mixes. I know it's apples to oranges, but in the grand scheme of things.
True.
What? True which?
I would eat Kraft Singles before I would eat pre-bagged Bloody Mary mix. Kraft Singles any day.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to throw out two random ones for you.
Okay.
Brian. One, V8 is a base instead of other stuff. Hate?
Well, I have to backtrack a little bit.
But
I grew up not liking V8 or tomato juice.
The hell?
Like, do you like walk like crooked all the time?
I never drank it. It was something I tried. I think I tried it when I was a little kid, and I didn't like the taste of it. But my palate evolved.
Do you know what I really love a lot? I used to love the weird little cans with the pull tab and the absurdly small teardrop-shaped hole in the V8 can.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
Those are great. No, but V8...
This goes to show no one actually wanted to drink it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sucking the V8 out of that can with that little
V8's
hole.
V8's thinner, which is why I think people who don't like Bloody Marys are more akin to actually being open-minded about liking stuff like that. It's actually a vast... I'm impressed by, like, how people feel about, like...
It was a gateway drug to gazpacho for me.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. The thick, soupy Bloody Marys, the thinner...
What about an alcoholic gazpacho?
I think the gazpacho actually brought me to the Bloody Mary, because I never liked the Bloody Mary, but I do like gazpacho.
Gazpacho is delicious. You know what I don't like? Blended gazpacho that hasn't been put through a vacuum to suck the air out. Gazpacho that looks like a freaking foamy mess.
What if you're like getting the salmoreño, the one that's made with the bread, like torn leftover bread from
that's
the night
good.
Before?
You should still hand chop it and let it soak in. You shouldn't blend the hell out of it so that it's all foamed and airy.
True.
That's like a nightmare. That just means that you hate quality. You hate everything. This is why you cheat and use a blender but own a vacuum machine so you can suck the air out and get the color back in the gazpacho. This was literally the first thing I taught people how to do in culinary school with the vacuum machine, is take tomato puree and stop it from looking like nonsense that comes out of a freaking blender.
Yeah, BS orange stuff.
Yeah.
It's so gross.
Gross, disgusting. People don't like that. All right, so here's another one for you.
Yep.
Ready, Brian?
Yep.
Okay, so I'm playing my wife.
Okay.
And you're playing me.
Okay.
Convince me. I don't like drinking in the morning. I don't want a Bloody Mary. You're a dumbass. Now, convince me.
I'm playing you?
You're me, yeah. Convince me. Convince me as my wife.
Did your wife call you a dumbass?
Like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Remember, channel unemotional robot.
Yeah.
Okay, but like, all right, I don't understand. Why do you just not like drinking in the morning? Like,
it doesn't sound like me. You're asking someone else's feelings. This doesn't sound like me.
When you say you don't like drinking in the morning, do you mean alcohol or do you mean all things? Because I've seen you drink coffee.
Yeah. So, all right. Let's.
I don't want to drink alcohol. What am I, an alcoholic? First of all, this is soupy. This is the morning.
Do you go to meetings? No, you know, not an alcoholic.
Dave, we have kids. This is irresponsible. Why would I want to drink
vegetarians?
Morning?
What do you care about it anymore?
Oh, like, now you're just, now
you
you're
want to say V8.
I have to break character. I have to break character now.
Why don't we take the Virgin Mary and
just
trying
to hurt me?
V8. And, make it. There's tons of vitamins and vegetables in V8. So if we give the kids,
all right, listen. I don't want to have alcohol in the morning. Why should I have alcohol in the morning?
Why should you not have alcohol in the morning?
Because I do what I want.
Why should you have alcohol in the morning?
This is from three bartenders. Here's the point. Try to convince... Okay, it's a well-known fact that once you're in an airport, there is no time.
We're convincing... Okay, I've got a good
idea. Here, it's real simple. If you don't want to drink in the morning, don't do it. No one cares. No peer pressure.
Yeah, but Brian wrote a book on Bloody Marys, which is a drink you're only allowed to drink in the morning. What do you think about people who...
You can drink it anytime you want.
What?
Listen... If you want it, just drink it.
You can drink it if you want.
You're allowed to drink it. Wait. Are the three of you saying that I can walk into a bar in the evening time when the sun has gone down?
Certainly.
And say, excuse me, I work in the nighttime. This is the morning. Give me a Bloody Mary. Or can I say, I'm a regular person. This is the nighttime for me and I would like a Bloody Mary.
You can, in fact, say that.
Wait. So this is yet another barrier to good taste that has been thrown out the window. Like, when you're allowed to wear white clothing, when you're allowed to order a gin and tonic.
You may be a poor quality human being.
Oh.
But you could say it.
Yeah, well, I could do anything. I could shove pencils up my nose like Blockhead, but I don't.
But you could also drink in the afternoon if you want.
But my point
is...
Because
I do what I want.
My point is that you don't order Bloody Marys at night, do you? Have you ever
ordered? I order Bloody Marys never.
Oh, all right. Why?
Give me a tequila and sangrita. I'm in. Michelada, I'm in. Bloody Mary, not my
okay,
thing.
So let's have this talk. The man wrote a book on Bloody Marys. This is what I'm trying to get to. The man wrote a book on Bloody Marys. Here we have Don Lee, supposedly benevolent cocktail overlord. Kevin Denton, Grand Vizier of Pernod Ricard, USA. And I have a man that says he doesn't order. What about you, Kevin? Let's be honest. Do you order Bloody Marys?
When I want one.
Which is?
Occasionally.
When?
Typically when I want some... You know, the best time to have a Bloody Mary is on a long morning flight when you don't leave first thing in the morning. Like, first thing in the morning, I just want to go to sleep, right?
Right, okay.
when you, like, board at 8 and you're on, like, a 3 or 4 hour flight. The thing is, the Mrs. T's spicy Bloody Mary mix...
Is that a thing that exists?
Without a doubt.
Who's this lady? Is she related to Mr. T?
Me.
It's actually Mr. and Mrs. T's.
Really?
Right. It was
but
of
it
them.
Is Mr. T?
No.
The Mr. T?
It's
Mr.
nice
T's
that they did it
not,
together, right?
It's not B.A. Baracus.
Oh. Well, I mean, you know, that's a character. Mr. T is a human.
It's true.
At any rate.
I pity the fool.
once you have that, like, sometimes you want that chilled, salty, savory thing to sort of press the button that some peanuts or some garbage, like, cookie is not going to press.
Delta makes delicious cookies. Morning flight, man.
When you fly cattle class, you don't get the delicious cookies, all right? You're in the back, and you're like, I'm going to split this Mr. and Mrs. T's with somebody next to me because 12 ounces is too much of it, and you need to cut it, like, with a little bit of water. But when it's a little watered down and a little salty and a little savory, that's kind of a lifesaver mid-meal, particularly if you're flying and changing a bunch of time zones and you're getting in like, oh, we're closed for lunch at 3, or it's morning where you are now. Like, it's sort of a mediator of time zones where you can have a savory thing anytime.
You know when I like it? When I like it best, because I'm not a morning drinker either. I don't like drinking in the morning. And, you know, I don't do brunch that often. And when I do, it's with kids and not with adults, so I'm not drinking. I like Bloody Mary not in a full cocktail format. I like it in a shorter shot format, in a group, before I'm about to have a bunch of raw bar. Like, because to me, like, those, like, go together really well. So, like, you're going to have, like, the equivalent of a half a cocktail. You're going to shoot it real fast, and you're going to have it right before you're about to pound, like, a whole boatload of, like, mussels, shrimp, oysters, that kind of stuff. That's a win. Crab, if you're going to have a lot of crab, Bloody Mary, tomato, delicious. This is a good mix.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure, if you're cocktail a weenie sauce. That has to have cocktail sauce with their raw bar, I mean...
Did I say I was going to pour cocktail sauce on my raw bar?
You pretty much did by saying you wanted a Bloody Mary beforehand.
Look, I'm being told that we've already been going... I've not answered a single question, which I have many.
Classic.
So we're going to go to a commercial break in a minute. I'm not saying I have to cocktail sauce on my raw bar. In fact... Like, if you take the time to dip crab meat into anything, you have wasted time. You just need to shovel, like, crab meat into your face as fast as you can. Can we all agree, for the love of God, that crab is the most superior crustacean that exists? Crab is infinitely superior to lobster.
For meat.
Yeah.
Lobster shells, I think, make a better stock.
Fair. Shrimp heads also make an excellent stud.
Also true. Also delicious when fried.
Yes. Mm. I love sucking on shrimp heads. But for meat, sucking on shrimp heads...
Crab is king.
Crab.
Crab is king. I'm a king. Crab.
Okay. By the way, have you guys ever had live king crab cooked directly, not frozen?
No.
No, I've never been to Alaska.
You don't have to. You can spend a lot of money and have True World Foods owned by the Moonies.
I'm poor.
You can work for a company that does it for free. You think I paid for the king crab when I was working for FCI?
I spent all my money on
Kevin Denton, will you buy me king crab?
Kevin, can Pernod Ricard buy Don Lee some live king crab?
I'll cook it for you. And we're going to cut to commercial.
And listen, for those of you that haven't had the world's most dangerous catch live, like, live king crab is... as delicious as you think it is. It is just crazy delicious. Because crab meat is the sweetest, most umami-laden, delicious crustacean meat that can be bought.
Do you think masochistic crabs keep butter on them?
Are you familiar? I think I've spoken about this years ago. Are you familiar with the movie, what was it called? Was it called Night Shift with Henry Winkler?
And, multiple times.
Yes. Yeah, and yeah, so yes. Feed the tuna the mayonnaise while they're still alive, Kevin. That's what one should do. And we'll be back with more cooking issues. Modernist Pantry was created by food lovers and cooking issues fans just like you. Janie, Chris, and the Modernist Pantry family share your passion for experimentation and have everything you need to make culinary magic happen in your own kitchen. Professional chef, home cook, food enthusiast, no matter what your skill or experience, Modernist Pantry has something for you. They make it easy to get the ingredients and tools you need and can't find anywhere else, so you can spend less time hunting and gathering and more time creating memorable dishes and culinary experiences. Visit ModernistPantry.com today to discover why Cooking Issues listeners call Modernist Pantry the cook's secret weapon. Be sure to check out their new kitchen alchemy. It's not really new anymore, Dave. It's like, you know, Anyway, be sure to check out their new Kitchen Alchemy blog at blog.modernistpantry.com for free recipes, tips, and tricks. And don't forget to follow Modernist Pantry on social media to keep up with what's new and exciting in the world of culinary ingredients and tools. And we're back! So, Don Lee has brought us some interesting Kit Kats. What are these, Don?
These are sake Kit Kats. It's white chocolate Kit Kat that tastes like sake.
You know what are two words I don't like together? White and chocolate. You know, I was
chocolate, fat.
There you go.
Kit Kat tastes like sake.
I kind of understand what they mean by the sake, but it's in the finish.
I think it really tastes like sake.
Really tastes like sake.
I like it.
It's like Nigori sake.
Super ricey.
Preach, Kevin. You like that?
I really do.
Sake Kit Kat. Good call. Do you know, the chocolate rain fellow, Tezande, followed me recently. I put this on my Twitter feed.
I did see this.
Yes. He has followed 604,000 other people before he followed me. And I later found out, because I kind of called the robot that is Tezande's Twitter machine out on this fact. And he's like, well, if people follow me back, I keep them. And if they don't, I don't. So that means he probably followed 8 billion people before me. I'm probably literally the last Twitter person on Earth that Tezande has followed. But I did go back and listen to Chocolate Rain once because I was followed. You like Chocolate Rain.
Good man.
Everyone likes Chocolate Rain. We have some questions. We're ready to answer some questions?
Let's do it.
Questions. Hey, Dave, Nastasia, David in the booth. Dave is not here in the booth. Remember, I told you, I'm in Pittsburgh. Don, if you're there, nice. And, of course, everybody's favorite punching bag, Peter Kim. Alas, Peter Kim is not here. He's too lazy to come out to
Pittsburgh. He's in Africa.
He's in Tanzania right now.
Yeah.
He might actually still be in Ethiopia, and when he comes back from Ethiopia, he has a lot to report on because he is very interested in this special Ethiopian egg. So in Ethiopia, they have two kinds of eggs. Like foreigner eggs, which are like the normal eggs that we have, and special Ethiopian eggs, and he's going to try to run down. He's eaten some in the past couple days. He's going to try to run down what that is. He's also going to try to tell us about interesting foods he had in.
You can follow him on Instagram. He's been posting pictures of eggs, right?
Yeah. If you want to follow Peter Kim on Instagram, I recommend that. Yeah, he's been posting some egg pictures. Anyway, he's not here, so we can't beat on him. I have some downtime soon. I was hoping to have another look at the miracle of moisture management in COMSOL. This is the program. This is Nick Devlin, who I'm working with. Yeah. So look for more COMSOL stuff coming in the future. And by the way, his wife, Naomi, writes cookbooks, including some gluten-free cookbooks, and worked with my man. I never met him. I don't know why I'm calling him my man. Hugh Fearnsley Whittinghall from the River Cottage. You ever know about these books?
Yeah.
You reading these books?
No.
Good books. Anyway, question. I'm thinking about our bar's autumn menu and wanted to include a sherry flip. A flip. All right, so you're good that we have bar people here because I know nothing about the modern flip. Anyway, but I'm mulling over options as far as egg safety for those nervous customers. The internet suggests a minimum of 1 hour at 57 degrees up to 2 hours for sous vide pasteurization, you know, low temperature like in the shell. Firstly, what are your thoughts on the time? Secondly, what would the shelf life of a batch of eggs be after pasteurization? I've also read they can be harder to whip after you've pasteurized them and that it might affect the texture of the flip, so I'll need to run some tests. Looking forward to getting the spins all later this summer and celebrating with a gin and juice at the bar. Of course, gin and juice is one of my favorite drinks. Don, when we open the bar again, are we going to have gin and juice again, or are you going to make me have only cocktails?
Yes.
Which... I gave you two options, and you said yes.
And one of them's right.
Ah, you guys are the worst people in the world. So first of all, define for those who aren't bar people a modern flip. Don't give me flip dog. Don't give me that. What? Give me flip. Define flip.
Whole egg. Shake and drink.
Okay. It's typical base. Give me a typical recipe. Give me a typical spec.
I'm a big fan of the ruby port in a flip, the coffee cocktail, classic drink. No coffee in it. Tastes like coffee. Ruby port, whole egg, shake it up.
So
maybe a little simple.
Another classic drink that doesn't contain its own ingredient: the Flaming Dr. Pepper, lemon heart, amaretto. Do you like that?
Man, I was never a Dr. Pepper fan.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! You don't like Dr. Pepper the soda?
Listen, Korean upbringing. I didn't have soda until I got to college.
I didn't ask you when you started having soda. I asked you don't like Dr. Pepper.
I could take it or leave it,
Kevin.
I didn't have tequila till college, and I love it now.
There you go. By the way, we could talk. Oh, by the way, not to go back because I know we already talked about the Bloody Mary. Why would you ever order a Bloody Mary? No offense. Why would you ever order a Bloody Mary with vodka when you could just have it with tequila instead?
Or gin. Just throwing it out there.
My preference is mezcal. Or Dr. Pepper.
Do you call it a Maria, or do you just call it a Bloody Mary with mezcal in it?
Actually, there's no name for a Bloody Mary Oaxaca with Bloody Oaxaca.
Don't they call it a Maria? Isn't that a Maria?
Bloody Maria is tequila.
So now you're going to be so freaking anal on me, like mezcal. Okay.
Maybe it's a Bloody Mario? Mario.
Please. Like, these people haven't been hanging out with us all week. They don't know about the Mario Brothers.
I think it's an important question that needs to be put out to the world. Is it Mario or Mario?
We're answering a question about egg safety. Okay. It is Mario Kart and Mario Brothers. They're different.
Has there ever been a Bloody Mary flip, by the way? Or a Prairie Oyster flip?
That is freaking disgusting. I'm throwing up in my mouth a little bit.
That's eggs in purgatory, right?
If you scramble the egg beforehand and turn it into some sort of, like, omelet.
Prairie Oyster cocktail predates the Bloody Mary.
All
right. Wait. Question. Egg safety.
Egg safety. So back to egg safety, Nick. The 1 hour is sufficient at 57 degrees once it gets up to 57. But the fact of the matter is, salmonella is what you're shooting for. It'll probably pasteurize earlier than that. I usually do 57 degrees for about an hour. 2 hours is not going to hurt it, or you can drop it. Look, 57 degrees Celsius is like 135 Fahrenheit. And after about an hour, the egg white will be slightly thickened, but not a lot. 2 hours, it's going to be a little bit more appreciably thickened. You'll still be killing salmonella if you drop it down to 56 after that first hour, and the inside will already be hot, so you might want to do that. I've never actually run the test of 57 versus 56. I have, 57 versus 1 hour versus 57 degrees for 2 hours. I have run with Kenta Goto after he got falsely accused of serving raw eggs without mentioning them on the menu at Pegu Club years ago, of raw egg versus sous vide pasteurized egg versus box pasteurized egg. Box pasteurized eggs are a garbage product for garbage people, made for garbage consumers. They should never be purchased, bought, or used. If you see someone purchasing, buy them or use them, you should provide an intervention. You should throw them out. And you should excoriate your supermarket for selling them. They're a bad product. But pasteurized eggs that you make yourself are pretty good, but not quite as good as raw eggs. But it's not that big of a difference. But they're totally safe, and they keep a long time. I mean, eggs, frankly, keep a long freaking time. So eggs that you pasteurize are certainly going to keep a long freaking time. I would say that you are not affecting the keeping time. You're pasteurizing them. But you're also possibly washing off any wax that's on the outside of the eggshell. So that's probably – the point is moot. I would just say that you have not affected their keeping at all.
Just use it raw.
Some people are really freaky about it. And I agree with you, Don. Some people – here's an interesting test that someone can run for me that I didn't. You guys are all familiar with wet dog, right? So – and you take an egg white – and you crack a fresh egg white into a drink and you shake it. After a couple of minutes, you may or may not get, although you often do, the aroma that I call wet dog. Very similar to using transglutaminase, meat glue, on something, you get this wet dog aroma. And, famously, people put bitters on the top of their egg white drinks. And people are doing it because it's pretty. No, it's to cover up the stench of the egg white. And so one way around this is to crack your egg whites a good 2 to 3 hours before a shift, let them flash off in a core container, close them, put them, afterwards you can close them, and no wet dog, because you flashed off all of whatever the precursors to the wet dog are. But what I've never done is tested whether or not wet dog happens after pasteurization. But that would be an interesting test, wouldn't it?
Can't you kind of cover it up too with like osmotic oils and things like that if you put... Kind of like when you put eggs in rice with a truffle and it sort of absorbs that truffly flavor.
Before you crack them?
Yeah.
I've never heard of this.
We Tony Conigliaro did it. I can't remember the compound, but he was going for the fresh cut grass.
Yeah, he did it with hay, and he did like a smoked hay thing. And he, you know, it's like a truffled egg. You know, when you put an egg in the thing and it picks up the aroma of the truffle. I don't know. I will say, not osmosis. Osmosis, specifically the random movement of water across a semi-permeable membrane.
So it's a semi-permeable membrane.
But only water. The movement of water. Oh. Not movement of anything else. Osmosis is specifically when water moves.
So when is it like an aromatic compound? How does that
penetrate? It's an infusion of some sort. You know, it's picking up some flavors.
So there's not a good
word, but it's not osmosis.
Yeah. Okay.
But all I can say for sure is I've never tested any of this, so I can't say. Where did Tony write about this stuff?
In his book.
The second one?
I think the first one.
First one?
I heard him talk about it. Many years ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, go look it up. But it's an interesting test. I would like to test. And fortunately, the person who asked the question, Nick, lives in England, so can go ask. But the it's an interesting question. I don't know whether pasteurization is going to affect the wet dog aroma or not. All right, let's go to the next question. This is from Matt Z. I recently got into kegging sparkling water, but right now it's just filtered tap water, which, by the way, is the best. You know what? You know what? Like, seltzer water should just be ripping, purified water. Ripping, delicious, purified water. I think, let me finish the question. I'm wondering if you have dabbled into trying to mimic mineral water from specific sources or any additions to make it taste better. And if so, do you have a good jumping off point? Is it worth it? Any other way to up my fizzy water game? Matt Z. Okay. Darcy O'Neill from The Art of the Drink and from his well-known soda book from like 6 years ago called Fix the Pumps, which is apparently a boob reference. Do you know that? Boob reference.
So when the soda jerks were working, they'd say to each other, hey, you got time to fix the pumps.
Go
check out the lady that just walked in.
But specifically a woman who's stacked.
Correct.
That's the... Which I don't really like those references.
Scumbags.
Scumbag reference. But anyway, Darcy used it, and he doesn't strike me as a scumbag.
No, good man.
Yeah.
Canadian,
yes. But, yeah.
So he's a nobleman.
Yeah. Anyway, point being that Darcy is also in his real life work job, chemist, and did a bunch of work on researching old articles for ersatz mineral waters. And a lot of the mineral waters have been classified as to their exact mineral composition. And so he has a lot of recipes about recreating these mineral waters, and you can look them up. And Martin Lerche from Chymos, who is the famous compiler of hydrocolloids recipes called Textures or something, also has a compilation of all of these water recipes. I have never had one work. I have bought a bunch of the stuff and tried to mimic, for instance, some waters that I enjoy. So for those of you, some waters that you can purchase that I enjoy are Gerolsteiner. I enjoy Gerolsteiner because I like heavily... I'm either going to have seltzer with no minerals in it or I'm going to go freaking mineral on you. So I like Gerolsteiner. I like Vichy Catalan, which I think is delicious. I like regular Vichy. I like Apollinaris. These are all good waters, and I've tried to mimic some of these waters, and I have been, in a word, unsuccessful. Darcy points out quite rightly that you have to add things in certain orders, and the solubility is really hard, but the way that real mineral waters are formed is deep in the earth, in rock, under high pressure over a long period of time, sprouting up under pressure, and then you get them like that. And then, in fact, especially carbonated mineral waters, because why would you drink flat mineral water? We are not animals. Like, what? I can drink any sort of water that's flat. I can drink garbage. The word for water that is derived from rainfall is meteoric. So any water that is primarily derived from recent rainfall is meteoric water. And if you're going to drink meteoric water, then just drink tap water, unless you live in Florida where the tap water is garbage, or if you live in Hong Kong where the tap water is garbage. Who else has terrible tap water? People, who has terrible tap water? Anyone? You're not going to shout out your favorite horrible tap water?
Los Angeles for a long time.
Had bad tap water?
Terrible tap water.
Southwest's got to have some terrible tap water.
Flint definitely winning right now.
Oh, but that, water. I mean, that's just you're being mean. Like, they, like, poison.
You
want to
do
water.
Some, like, fracking water you set on fire water?
Cleveland, you mean? Fire water from the rivers?
All along it.
The Cuyahoga.
Yeah. All the salt oil deposits.
So you're saying I'm just spoiled? Like I have.
Yeah, you are very spoiled.
In general.
Water rich.
We are water rich. Like not only does New York have delicious tap water, but we can shower and poop in it, and not have to worry about a running dry.
You're not a survivor of the great drought of California in the 2010s.
No, but I flew over that once, and it was crazy looking. You know what I mean? Like, you fly over California during heavy drought time, and you're like, this should not exist. My produce should not be this cheap. You know what I mean? It's like...
Honestly, all I can still think about is the joke that if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the precipitate.
Strong. You know, New York...
That's one of those things that could also go.
Yeah, but anyway, back to water. Very fortunate... anyway, meteoric water is relatively soft, hasn't had time to pick up a lot of flavor. If it has, it's from urine, poop, and effluent. So it's
possibly like, dinosaur urine.
No, not if it's meteoric water. That's what I'm saying. If it's meteoric water, if it's recent water, it's like all of the pollution is recent pollution, like bacteria, nasty, nasty stuff, and you don't want that.
This is why you're going to dig deep.
Dig deep. That's right. So you want to get stuff, and this is why certain like marketing fools, like the Fiji people, say that their water is X number of thousands of years old. But if you really want badass water, you have to go millions of years old. And to go millions of years old, you got to tap some deep seated stuff. And if you really want to do that, and you live in the New York area, you're going to want to go to Saratoga Springs. Saratoga Springs has the most badass, non-meteoric, like millions-of-year-old water that you can possibly find. And that stuff is salty and crazy and good in small quantities that don't make you rush off to the bathroom. Because, frankly, highly mineralized water is like it's like Belmont steaks for your butt. You know, it's like it just... Boom! Makes you want to go like nobody's business. It's like coffee on steroids. So if you made coffee with this stuff, which would taste horrible, by the way.
Don't do it.
So don't do it. But if you have... I have had a coffee with it. So I drank like the most hardcore of the Saratoga Springs waters, which is Hathorn 3, which is the most highly unmixed water, the most deep earth salt water. It's about a third of the salinity of salt of ocean water. And that stuff and a coffee is supposed to make you, like, have to run while you're set on spray to the bathroom to try to get there in time. And I have to report back, not to brag, but I am Iron Butt. I am Iron Butt. I was not phased.
This is why you will be patient zero in the super poop, you know, poop exchange.
That's correct. We've discussed this before. We can get back to it at some point. Point being,
I will say that I had those waters when you brought them in.
They're interesting, right?
I can do like verification of this.
You had the search for deliciousness that we made with that instead of the salt, right? That's pretty weird. I think if you did bottle it, use it like saline, it would be real nice. It's got a little weird like a radioactive thing going on the back of the throat.
Some of them are radioactive from the Polaris. The Polaris spring specifically is radioactive. But the issue is that these are formed under very high pressure. So if you let those things go flat, a lot of the interesting minerals precipitate out. So you're part of the precipitate in this case, and the water has died. So it's very hard to take uncharged water, not under pressure, and recreate the same mix that you would get from the spring. So the answer is I've not had a lot of success. This is a long way to say no. This is a very long explanation to say no. Right?
And yeah, at the same time, New York is still like, from your resources of the way that you're referencing water, Saratoga Springs being like the best of the best, right? Like,
so, I mean,
locally.
I think that Saratoga Springs, they don't bottle, so the stuff that you call Saratoga water is garbage meteoric water.
Yeah, it's
garbage. No offense to them and their blue bottles, but that is not the water of millionaires. That's not what people travel hundreds of miles or thousands of miles to take the cure in. That's just like water that was rain a couple of weeks ago. That right. is not the stuff.
What about that deep Canadian stuff?
I have a years-long dream, Don. And that years-long dream is to go to the Timmins Zinc Mine in Ontario, Canada, to go 2 kilometers deep into a hole in the ground and find the spring, which I happen to know, I'm told that the water that springs out of it is extremely valuable and can't be wasted. But I also know that the scientists don't capture all of it and that it leaks out at a rate of approximately 2 liters a minute. And that this water has not gone through the water cycle in approximately 2.4 billion years. And that it's incredibly salty, and that this guy wants to use it in a cocktail, and some freaking Canadian scientist won't let me have it, even though I've emailed her several times saying that I am in fact not a crank, and I'm a real person with real credentials who would like some of her water.
Modern day Ponce de Leon, you are.
The fountain of old, baby. Okay, we have a question from Dan. For a couple, I think I've answered this. Did I talk recently? Did I remember about BPE in Rubbermaid containers? Rubbermaid.
You did.
All right, Dan. If I've not answered your Rubbermaid BPA questions, text us back. We got a question from Victoria, British Columbia, in Canada. And let's see what we got here. Hey, Dave, the Hammer, and other Dave who's not here right now. Question from Canada. I know you love us, even though you like to give us plenty of grief. Hey, your brother, you're our brothers and sisters from up north. So, you know, why would we not give you grief? You like to give Canada grief,
that's,
right?
That's how you know we love you.
So, yeah, so how do you know that I don't like you?
You never talk about them. Don't think about them.
Yeah, right.
Motionless robot doesn't think about things.
Yeah. If I say anything about you at all, that's like, you know.
He cares enough to hate you.
No, I don't hate Canada. You know what? You know when I hated Canada? Remember that, like, period of a couple of years? I'll never forget this. So, like, you know, American money always kicks Canada's money's butt, right? Like, this is not, like, this is just our money is historically, in my life, worth more than the Canadian dollar. So, like, my wife and I could go to Niagara Falls, enjoy the better Canadian side of the falls. We have the garbage falls. The U.S. has the crappier part of the Niagara Falls situation. But you can go over there, and even if you don't have a lot of money, the American dollar is so strong that you're like, woo! You
know, Tim Hortons.
Yeah, as many donuts as you want, honey. Do it. You know what I mean? So, point being that, remember a couple years ago when the Canadian dollar reached parity with the American dollar?
Oh, yeah, it was beating us for a while.
Yeah, and I was like, this is what we get. This is our punishment. But we're back now.
Question.
Yes. Oh, Canada. Love it. I love listening to your show. I've been a semi-frequent reader of your blog, and I've been happy to have your shows to listen to while I make a small batches of ice cream over here in the west coast of British Columbia. Keep up the good work. You have a love affair for Crosby's molasses. I do. Crosby's molasses is delicious. Any of you guys northern people? Northern people?
Northern. How north?
What?
How
like,
north?
Freaking Maine north.
Well,
like Nanook of the north?
That's
Maine.
Northeastern. I'm Midwestern North. Like, I'm North Midwestern.
In Madison, Wisconsin, where you are from,
yeah.
Do they have Crosby's molasses on their cheese curds or not?
No. Nor on their bratwurst, good sir.
Brats. Do you eat pasties or pasties, whatever you call them?
Nope.
That's only a Minnesota thing?
That's Minnesota.
Oh, too good for you? You don't like a meat pie all of a sudden?
It gets them away the bratwurst.
All right. Okay.
Question.
Crosby's molasses. What gives? You live in the U.S., so why not get sorghum syrup? I will gladly mail you as much Crosby's as you want in trade for any good sorghum syrup. I've never had good sorghum syrup.
I don't think it exists.
But it could exist. It's a traditional...
Like a Philly cheesesteak.
Oh, Don Lee does not believe that he has ever had a good... Philly cheese.
Well, I know I've never had a good one, but there might be a good one out there, much like sorghum syrup.
Don't be freaking absurd. And by the way, like, I don't understand why Philadelphia gets to own the freaking cheesesteak. Cheesesteak is an inherently delicious concept and also very well executed on many situations. What could you possibly not like about sautéed shaved steak with melted cheese and sautéed onions on a roll, Don?
Well, if you took those rolls and dipped them in jus, you'd have a great French dip a la Philippe's. Los Angeles style.
No, but French dip doesn't have cheese and onions.
It doesn't need it because it's delicious with meat and the juices of meat.
It's a different sandwich.
Thank you, Kevin.
Fully different sandwich. The drippy, like, jus sandwiches. That's a knife and fork thing, or it's like a multi-napkin thing, whereas the Philly cheesesteak is great in that you have goopy singles or cheese whiz as processed cheese no matter what.
As an adult, I like Gruyere on a cheesesteak.
I'm Philly cheesesteak agnostic.
Kind of BS.
I'm not an atheist. It's not like I say there is no good Philly cheesesteak. I just haven't met the good Philly cheesesteak yet, so I'm open to it.
I think it's like a... It's like a thing, and, you know, the good version of it is going to be different than the original thing. Not saying the original is the best interpretation of it, but, like, if you're calling something by its name, a Philly cheesesteak is, like...
I just call them cheesesteaks.
Overcooked...
I don't add the Philly because I'm not from Philadelphia. I feel like I can make a decent cheesesteak.
What's your thought on the chopped cheese?
What do you mean chopped cheese?
Chopped cheese.
Tells chopped cheese.
You never had like the uptown like Bronx chopped cheese?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like a bodega?
Uptown.
What are you talking about?
Oh, man.
Oh, wow. Mm.
The cheese in the...
We got to take you uptown, Dave.
Guess we got the next episode sorted out.
What?
Next episode of Cooking Issues coming to you live from a bodega.
Of Philly cheesesteak, but it's chopped cheese.
Where do they make it? Harlem? Is it Harlem dish?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's called chopped cheese?
Chopped cheese.
You walk in and you say, chopped cheese, please.
Yeah, but it's not
just... We're in Harlem. Only if you want to rhyme.
Oh, but chopped cheese is the actual dish it's called.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cheesesteak that they hack the cheese into the meat.
No, it's not a steak. It's like ground beef, kind of like a hamburger patty chopped up.
What about you guys? Anyone had this? Who's had this? You've had this? You've had this?
Never.
Okay.
This is a very, trendy thing to have right now.
Regional thing.
Well, this is big. Well, notice, I am not a trendy fellow.
Judging by your outfit, I don't believe you.
So,
listeners, if you could only see this outfit.
Salmon shirt. I have a very fetching salmon shirt. Anyway, point being.
Sorghum syrup.
I've not had this chopped cheese. I will try this chopped cheese. What kind of roll is the chopped cheese on?
It's like on a hero.
Yeah, it is a
hero. Well, please. This can mean anything. Are we talking like... A thin thing, like Dave, you might have a Cuban sandwich on? Are we talking like a meatball
sorghum syrup? Sorghum syrup.
Now you have me on the chopped cheese. I told you I haven't had a decent sorghum syrup. If I had a decent sorghum syrup, I would call Surly Dave right now and be like, here is my decent sorghum syrup. Send me as much Crosby's molasses as you can. But I have not. Have any of you guys had a decent sorghum syrup?
Never.
Is it a traditional sweetening agent, and so it would be good to get.
Do you guys know about the molasses flood?
Oh, yeah, of course. Boston. 1919. Right before Prohibition. So my great aunt Annette was alive during that time and remembers it. She used to work at the Schraff's factory in Boston and was like, it still smelled like molasses in the summertime. She didn't talk like that. She was from Boston. And she was the last surviving of the three maiden aunts on my stepfather's side. And vividly remembered that because... she was born in 1909, so she was like 10 years old when that happened. So that was a legit thing. And she, imagine this little old lady in this factory stuffing candies into Schraff's cups. Auntie Annette, you know what? It's kind of sad. Recently, the last of that whole generation in my family and my stepfather's family died. So I have no more connection other than my crazy stories to that whole kind of generation. But yeah, the molasses flood was amazing. I think it was... If my memory serves me, it was like it got hotter than normal on that day. They'd overfilled the molasses bin. It was a cheap rate molasses that had a little bit too much water. Fermentation started. The container was also built poorly, and kaboom. And imagine, like, how did your uncle die, Jimmy? He drowned in molasses. You're like, what? He couldn't outrun the molasses in January? He was kind of slow. I'd like to drop it now. You know what I mean? Because, like, how do you tell people that your family members were killed by a wave of molasses? Horses were killed by it. A lot of people killed, and interestingly, they had overfilled the molasses because people, it was just prior to Prohibition. Now, it might be a little bit of a canard in that story because the people that owned that molasses tank were one of the few people that were actually licensed to produce alcohol for industrial use. And so they could have continued to produce molasses. But well-known fact by everyone in this kind of alcohol room here is that Prohibition killed Medford rum, which no longer exists, which was drunk by Paul Revere on his ride and is still commemorated to this day in Medford, Massachusetts by a dram of rum at a particular doorstop. Wayne Curtis told me that, even though like I grew up going to Medford. I had no idea. Wayne Curtis, the rum historian, taught me that. And also Monongahela rum here was pretty much destroyed by Prohibition.
True story.
Rye. I meant rye. When I said rum, I meant rye. But a lot of good things were destroyed by Prohibition. But, you know, without it, all the pre-Prohibition people wouldn't have a job, would they? Would Sasha have become so famous if there hadn't been a Prohibition and a crappy interregnum years where we had garbage cocktails? Would he have been so well-known?
I never thought you'd be such an optimist, but you managed to find the bright side to Prohibition, so.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good gangster movies.
There's another.
That's true.
No Boardwalk Empire without Prohibition.
Yeah.
Yeah. You like that, right? You're a Steve Buscemi fan, aren't you?
I look just like him.
What? I served a drink to Steve Buscemi.
That's just
Semi
a thing
once.
That no one ever wants to say.
I served a drink to Steve Buscemi once. Good guy. Okay, second question. As stated, I make ice cream for a living. Recently, I've been getting many requests for Tiger or Tiger Tail ice cream, which I understand it is a very Canadian flavor. Is this true? Well, it sure is crap ain't an American flavor, I'll tell you that. No one's heard of Tiger Tail. We had to look it up on the internet. Do you not get Tiger Tail in New York City? We do not. The we that
not
is me
yet.
Do not. No,
we don't
not
even
yet.
Get Moose Tracks.
We get Moose Tracks. All you have to do is go to Connecticut.
Again, New York City. Have you ever walked into a bodega and gotten Moose Tracks?
I don't walk into bodegas at all.
Well, la-di-da.
La-di-da.
You've been proving time and time again on this talk that you are the 1%. You get the good cookies on Delta.
I shop at a fine fair. I shop at a fine fair, which is like right equal to a Key Foods in a sea town, right? Don't give me this crap.
Well, let's be honest,
I don't have I don't have the money to pay the middleman bodega. I can't afford the convenience of shopping right downstairs from where I live, people. Anyway, Tiger Tail, Kevin, why don't you tell us what Tiger Tail is?
It's an orange flavored ice cream with a black licorice swirl. And it looks really wild. It's pretty psychedelic. It's popular in Canada, but seldom found elsewhere. Created by Morgan Carr, according to Wikipedia. Orange and black licorice is distinct.
Guys, quick bet. How likely is it that the person who sent this question created a fake Wikipedia page about the Tiger Tail?
No, come on.
60%.
It's a non-zero number, right? It is a non-zero number.
Everything's a non-zero number. Well, no, that's not true. Every probability is a non-zero number, greater. You know,
mostly.
So, Surly Dave, none of us, and while I myself live in a box, Don and Brian and Kevin get out a lot, so I'm assuming that this doesn't exist in New York, but here's what I'm going to say. Americans hate licorice. Let me repeat this. Americans hate licorice. And so I don't think it's ever going to become popular here, but I would like to try it. I really like creamsicles. Orange and vanilla is like...
Yeah, orange and licorice is kind of just like stomping that in the dirt.
Do you not like licorice?
Wait, hold on. Yeah, you got flack from the last issue that you are not a discerning ice cream eater because you did not call for a specific brand of ice cream. And I'd like to come in your defense, Kevin. That unless you're buying ice cream for yourself, when have you ever been offered an option of two different brands of ice cream in a like retail establishment ever?
I think it's a full non-starter. And also, I would love to throw in the
Kevin Denton eats those crappy unified brand ice cream sandwiches that weigh like a half a gram per liter.
Your sandwich shirt is out of line. I've taken to making my own ice cream recently, And I think that's the only way to go.
What? That's not true. Most home ice cream machines are garbage.
So I'm going to do a pitch for Breville and have them, you know, be your next sponsor because their home ice cream machine is pretty dope.
Let me ask you a question, Kevin. The ice cream out of your machine, I'm sure it's good the minute it's made. What about the next day?
It's better because then it hardens and crystallizes in a way that I think is superior than store-bought.
You lost me at crystals.
You lost me on crystals. You lost me with crystals.
It's creamy and delicious.
We will... Okay, I'll tell you what. Here's another question I have for you. This is the other answer. Because I'm a real butthead when it comes to this. How many minutes... What's your batch time in minutes?
I don't know.
Roughly.
60.
No, dude! Ice cream needs to be frozen in freaking 10 minutes or less. Or your crystal size is too large.
Says the man that usually has liquid nitrogen all the time.
All right. Maybe 15 minutes. All right. 60 minutes?
That's the... Hey, listen. I didn't purport to be ice cream girl.
Kevin, you know, we're friends... So what I want to do is I would like you to force me. I am an honest fellow, and I would like you to make ice cream and store it for a day. I will come over to your house all the way over in Brooklyn, and I will taste it, and I will see whether or not your stored overnight ice cream is actually as good as someone who spent millions of dollars on an instantaneous freezer that can freeze stuff instantaneously and has spent, I don't know, their whole life working on producing like awesome texture that is something.
You know, some of us can't afford that nice $1 million ice cream that you have.
1%.
Kevin Denton works for one of the largest liquor companies on planet of the earth and can get liquid nitrogen delivered to his office any damn day of the week. And can make ice cream as quickly and efficiently as anyone else. So I don't want to hear it.
You know, sometimes things are done best inefficiently. That's why I like a nice slow burn on mine.
Listen. All I'm saying is whenever anyone says ice cream, I don't get to taste it, you ask a couple of facts. One, what is the freeze time? That's the easiest thing to see. How long did it take to freeze? Because everybody knows the faster you freeze it, the smaller the ice crystals. And the smaller the ice crystals, Don...
The smoother the ice cream.
Boom, 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 boom. Okay. Hey, Dave, Nastasia et al. This is from Connor in Chicago. You've referenced on the show a few times that you used to roast... I still roast my own coffee. That you used to roast your own coffee using a Whirly Pop. I like the Whirly Pop.
Yeah.
Whirly Pop?
Yeah.
Whirly Pop. I'd like to try it myself, but my popcorn-loving girlfriend has some concern that if I use our Whirly Pop, it will be forever tainted with coffee flavor. Is this the case, or will it be okay to use for both purposes so long as we give it a good scrub? Any other roasting tips would be greatly appreciated. Thanks, Connor in Chicago. Connor, you have a smart girlfriend. That coffee will ruin your Whirly Pop for popcorn. It will turn your popcorn into garbage coffee oil popcorn, and you will not want to eat that. Guess what a Whirly Pop is? Not that expensive. If you're going to roast your own coffee, two batches of green coffee into roasted coffee in a Whirly Pop, and you've paid for the Whirly Pop. The problem with the Whirly Pop is that once you start... You guys know what a Whirly Pop is, right, Brian? Yeah. Right, Kevin? You know what a Whirly Pop is? You guys know Whirly Pop? Whirly Pop? Once you start cranking that Whirly Pop, you cannot stop. And, like, I am a well-known non-human, and so, like, I can sit there and just crank the Whirly Pop until it's done because... I don't care whether I have physical discomfort or whether I need to pee or whether the house is burning down or whether the dog is peeing or barking or whether my kids are shouting at me because right now what I'm doing is making coffee. Many people are not like this. And so what happens is they stop cranking it and walk away and then it burns. This is the problem. So I have a 3D model somewhere on my Insta, Twitter, where you can download something that you can convert a Whirly Pop into a motorized thing for fairly cheap, and it's pretty good. But the Whirly Pop is good. Just you got to keep cranking. I've since moved on. I built a drum roaster that's actually not quite as good as the Whirly Pop because it's too complicated to get into. But I still roast it on my own. As a first step into it, a Whirly Pop is great. Some people prefer the flavor of air popcorn popper coffee roasting. So there's basically, in the home coffee roasting world, there are two fundamental kinds of people, and they're the people who like drum roast kind of coffee, and those people typically are Whirly Pop, or if they have money, Harvest, you know, the mini drum roasters. And if I had a lot of money, I'd buy a Jabez Burns, or Jabez, I don't know how you pronounced it back when he was alive, sample roaster. And then there's the Air Pop people, who are based on kind of the Civets model of roaster. I used to air roast. I know Harold McGee likes an air roaster, but I kind of am a drum guy. What do you guys like? Do you guys even think about this? What are you, drum people?
Drum.
Drum. Kevin, do you have a feeling on this? Do you like air roasted? Do you like... Are you more of an espresso person or more of a drippy drip pour over drip drip drippy drip drip?
You know, I think I'm more of a working man on the coffee. I like drip coffee.
What does that mean, working man?
You know, just turning into a class.
He's
thing
calling
again.
You out on how rich you are.
Because I roast stuff in a popcorn machine. Because
you have an espresso maker.
That I bought on eBay was shattered and had to put together, like disassemble completely, like boil in water on the stove that I found on the street and then reassemble. That kind of rich? Anyways. This is what I'm trying to say. America, we have to get past this idea that because I like a particular kind of food, that it's a class issue. Just because I like to drink espresso doesn't mean that I hold my pinky out while I drink it.
Although he does.
That's also true.
Dave, time.
Hold on a second. Wait. Whoa. Let me see. Got some more questions. One more question. Can we do one more question?
We're going long.
Popcorn related?
Let's see what we got. This is from Sean Andrews. Last week, depending on when you read this, you took a question about a low temperature proxy for dry aging. I've not been able to stop thinking about dry aging since. This was someone who did like a warm hold on low temperature for meats to try to kickstart the enzymes in meats to tenderize it, you know, relatively quickly. The issue of trim loss from formation of the bad kind of crust during dry aging process seems ripe for analysis/optimization from someone who understands the miracle of moisture management. Listen, I've never said I understand the miracle of moisture management. I mean, I think I understand it more than most people, but I think that all of cooking fundamentally boils down to two things. One, getting the temperature right, and two, the miracle of moisture management. Because almost everything, crusts, like tater tots, French fries, name a food.
Jelly beans.
Moisture problem. Moisture management.
It's true. It's true. Sugar is hydrophilic.
Right.
It wants to pull the moisture out of the air. So it is, in fact, actually a moisture problem.
Right.
All candies are.
And how do you think you get that skin on it? By
it's Easter Sunday. That's how you get
cornstarch.
Yeah, moisture management, baby. That's like prime moisture management. Name another food.
Boom.
Name another
chicken wings.
Chicken wings, obvious moisture management.
Come on,
problem.
Anything fried.
Come on, man. More moisture management. Give me another.
I was
food.
Trying to give you a softball after jelly beans.
Beef jerky.
You're drying it out.
I'm drying it out purposefully.
What? You're making my point, people.
Giving you beans, I'm giving you jerky.
Everything. Beans and jerky. There is a jerky brand in Denver, and I'm not making this up.
It was in the airport.
Climax jerky. So. When you're getting on the airplane, you can buy yourself a package of Climax jerky if you so choose. Okay.
Never want to finish.
I got to finish the question. Miracle of Moisture Management. Side note, please write a book on the topic of moisture management and use this title. I'll start a petition if necessary. Listen, Sean, nobody else but you and I believe that the miracle of moisture management. Don also believes that the miracle of moisture management is a good title for a book, but we're, believe it or not, in the minority.
I think Moisture Intelligence. It's the second book in the Intelligence series.
The Art and Science of Moisture Management. I've read Kenji's posts on dry aging, which are pretty good, and I've looked into the literature on the subject, including dry aging of beef in a bag, highly permeable to water vapor, and you know, you give the DOI number, which is nice. But I'm left with the sense that more can and should be done. Since my wife's birthday present to me this year is allowing me to create my own dry aging setup, which will include a fridge, internal fan, UV source. The UV source is interesting, actually. So UV radiation on meat will prevent bacteria from growing. But what I don't think has been studied on long-term dry aging with UV is the possible rancidity caused by the UV light. Because fats are clearly going to go rancid quicker under UV light than not. So it's an interesting question. And various wireless sensors. I'd appreciate any thoughts you may have on the subject, including safety optimization and whether or not you personally think it's worth it. Note, I'm probably going to do it no matter what you think. Awesome, which is my favorite kind of person. I love the show. Good luck with the spins all, and thanks for your time. So, Sean, I don't really know the answer to your question. I'm going to actually put it out to the readers who have done more, listeners rather, who have done more work with dry aging. But I'm going to give it more thoughts. Somebody else had a question. Josh had a question, which Don is telling me I'm not going to have time to get to. But it's about whether or not you can do the old dulce de leche trick with honey. No, you cannot. So dulce de leche, I typically make it because I'm a cheater. I don't make it the grandma way, which is over an open pot stirring for a long time while it concentrates my reaction. I do it by taking sweetened condensed milk and putting it into a pressure cooker, which is the way 99.9% of people who aren't like good normal people do. The question is, can you do that with honey? Will that happen? Answer, no. You need the milk proteins, a bunch of it. There is protein in honey, but not enough to have the kind of dulce de leche thing happen. You might have some difference happen, but you're not going to get dulce de leche. But try it. Let me know. I have more questions, which I'm not going to get to because Don tells me that I'm out of time. And next week, back live in New York from Bushwick, Brooklyn, with more cooking issues. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.